Hello, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, fellow travelers along the way. Welcome to another episode of the Avalon Mentors Podcast.
Good afternoon, Dr. Thompson.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Lester. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. You know, that cirrhosis that you were talking about, I think we have a similar phenomenon, strangely enough. Hit us just
today.
So it's 10 o'clock and it's about 92 degrees here right now.
Fahrenheit. Oh, my goodness gracious.
It's tremendous. It's like
tremendously hot.
As they say around here, a sauna. A sauna.
A sauna.
It's like a sauna. So it's it's interesting. Certainly does give you a different perspective on things and the nature of the modern world and the luxuries that we enjoy, like air conditioning.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember when I was down in Texas, and in Texas you couldn't survive without air conditioning. I mean, you could survive, but it'd be really, really brutal. And so you'd go from one air-conditioned building to the next in your air-conditioned car. And they had air-conditioned ramp rails, you know, and walkways.
And like, an air-conditioned man in his air-conditioned house with an air-conditioned path to
you know, it was like some kind of space complex or something where you never left because the atmosphere was toxic or something.
Right.
But, I remember down there, you go for a run in the morning, it'd already be pushing 98 degrees, you know, and the armadillo starting to cook on the sides of the road. And Ooh, good times.
That's pleasant.
Good times. So here it's just, you know, it's, you look out, it's just this haze everywhere, and it's sultry as anything. So I'm trying to keep place cool while we do the program, but I'll probably rush into my air-conditioned house right afterwards. So,
yeah, but
how about you?
I have a technical question. I'm going to try something.
Sure.
I want to see if this works. If I just do a simple rotate, am I sitting sideways to you?
You
right
are
now?
Sideways.
It's it like doesn't Batman. Correct for him.
It's like the TV show, you know, the camera would go up and on.
Batman.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, and I suppose what we could do, I could go sideways too, but then mine actually has an auto rotate, so.
Yeah, does this, are we all right then now this way, or are we both just sideways? I suppose we're both side.
The way.
Both sitting sideways. All right, well,
right.
Maybe if I go like this, am I upside down?
Or yes, the entire show, actually.
Great. But there's no good solution. See, I'm being gently nudged by the machine to have to use the mobile phone.
What?
Of course, I have to have it plugged in to do this, which means I've got this cords, this tail sticking out the bottom, and I can't just properly set it anywhere.
What we need? We need a little voice on the machine that every time you try to do something, it would say, "I'm sorry, Commander Bowman, I can't do that."
That's right.
We feel right at home. Yeah. No, I don't. I don't have an easy solution on that score, my friend. Aside from just getting a tripod, I mean, that's what I use now. But so, speaking of technology, did you see the latest video for advertising for Meta, the new Meta thing?
No,
it's doing.
I don't.
You ought to check it out. It's really unnerving. It's
you're not selling me on it.
Gorgeous vistas and trees and water, and you can be out fishing with your dad, even though he's like dead or he's living somewhere else or whatever. You know, you can still fish.
Father's Day thing.
It's really the only strange thing I found about it was that the characters don't have arms. They don't no arms, so it's they've taken away that fundamental right to bear arms. You know, and which I think is highly symbolic.
Yes. Oh, funny.
No, it's funny. Interesting. You see,
I mean, that sounds like a. I mean, that what you're saying sounds like the you know like the synopsis of a Twilight Zone episode. Here, this you know, beautiful this or that. The only thing is, they didn't have arms.
Yeah. You know, no, it does. You're right.
Dear God.
It's like suddenly realizing something's terribly, terribly, terribly wrong, you know. And I have to address those things with humor, because otherwise the only other way to address them, aside from, you know, you have three ways to address them. Either humor or delight, like, yay, this is going to be so much fun, or horror.
I mean, right, run screaming from
the room. You know, it's like, oh my God, get me away from me. Yeah, it's the whole video is this beautiful video of this girl fishing with her dad out in the Adirondacks or somewhere, and really lovely scenery and eagles flying by and stuff. And then you look around and you start realizing this is all, it's all digital. It's all just constructed. It's part of the Matrix. That's what they should have called it. Not Meta, but
Matrix. Why not? Matrix.
That would be much better. Right.
Your default avatar could just be a Duracell battery.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, Duracell battery, but with arms, though, I think. That's important. But
with arms. Yeah, that's a key thing.
Yeah, maybe legs, but certainly.
Right. Well, in that case, just be an Energizer battery, and then you get the little pink bunny to go along with
it. Yeah, you could do that. You could identify as Pink Bunny on Meta and walk around.
That's true.
Go fishing with Pink Bunny Dad. It's truly obscene.
Oh, my goodness.
And you're right. The Twilight Zone element is definitely there, because you get that sense, like, this is going to be a perfect universe, but for one small thing. You know, you have to sew buttons onto your eyes, like in Coraline.
Right.
Or we're going to cut off certain soft parts of you and, you know, sacrifice them to the gods, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. You know,
everything that isn't the avatar, we could just cut those off. Yeah. And...
You know, I've always been a big fan of science fiction as a medium. Mm-hmm. Critiquing current events. And I remember back in the 70s, there was a movie called A Boy and His Dog. And I don't know if you ever saw this, but kind of a fun science fiction piece, post-apocalyptic, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And the guy has a dog, right? And really good friends with this dog.
Okay.
But at one point, he abandons the dog in order to go into this bunker where the people that have survived the Holocaust are setting up a new utopia. And it's great. They've got all this food. It's, you know, it's lovely and all this, but everybody's infertile. All the men are infertile. And so he's going to be the one man who's going to be able to repopulate the world. He's all excited. You know, it's going to be great. You know? 50 women for every man. I can live with that, Mr. President. And then at the very end of the, right near the end of the movie, the surprise thing comes on and there's no human interaction. There's no lovemaking at all. He's hooked up to a machine, basically.
And they just...
The take out of
extraction
theory, yes, and he escapes finally and gets back to his dog, but the whole movie is this commentary on where are we going with our technology and what looks beautiful on the surface might be really insidious, might be a sort of Trojan horse,
right?
And I don't know. I mean, maybe Meta is going to be the wave of the future, and we're all going to be much better in that air conditioned environment there in the Adirondacks. Who knows?
We'll be the wave, man.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. I find myself over and over again just thinking absurd thoughts about things like this, though, like absurd humor. So I saw a video today of somebody who was, they were going to throw them out because, you know, you can't videotape in here, you can't film in here. And the guy said, oh, no, she identifies as a camera. And so the other girls tried to throw them out. Oh, okay. So film, because she identifies as a camera. You can't argue with that.
Question that the gods have spoken.
Gosh, what a world! What a world!
Yeah.
So, indeed. We're here to talk about Tolkien and The Hobbit.
We are, among other things.
Okay, good. And as always, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And we are dealing with Fire and Water, Chapter 14.
Chapter 14.
Okay. Now, I'll say right off the bat, I love the chapter. It's great. But it's always been hard for me to talk about it. It's a short chapter, and it's like Smaug dies. Okay. So what do we got? What else you got there? The Jackson version, just to get this out of the way, the Jackson version, he has a big old dramatic thing. This is what the whole trilogy kind of leads up to. And then he has that second part of the trilogy, which is that big battle movie, the five armies.
The bloating of the five pages.
That's right.
As they say.
The bloating of five pages. But he has this huge action scene. It's lots of digital things happening, which is a little tiresome. Mm-hmm. And Polka does really the opposite in this chapter. Smog dies within like 3 pages, I think, maybe 4 pages.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then the rest of it is about the rebuilding of what they do afterwards and how they respond afterwards. And so it's kind of hard to say, well, what is it that we really want to talk about here, aside from the fact that this is just a neat chapter, have to get the dragon. And so I have some ideas, but let me pass the ball your way and see if you had anything in particular that you wanted to bring mm-hmm. here. And it doesn't have to be with the chapter either. It could be something else tooling alongside of Tolkien, you know, a fellow traveler alongside Tolkien. That sort of
thing. Right, right.
There, the band was playing while you were gone, so. That's something, just as a side note, something that I've found really interesting about our modern era. I don't know when this began. Maybe it's always been with us. But this constant need for entertainment and constant need for noise and constant need to have something happening. The ability to endure silence and the ability to endure just waiting for whatever it is that you're supposed to have happen has been greatly diminished during our time. And so even like in this here, if I were to sit silently for even a minute, I think the majority of people would be like, whoop, clicking elsewhere, you know, going elsewhere, bored, don't want to watch it. And people say, oh, my time is more precious. I don't have that much time to do this or that or whatever. And they don't, but they also, when they have the time, they end up wanting constant stimulation, constant noise. And I've been thinking a lot about, by the way, I'm just continuing here. I've been thinking a lot about how the effects of the technological age that started for us really, I would say, about the 80s. We're now seeing, after 40 years of it, we're seeing the fallout of that. And those who are observant are seeing the fallout of that. And I know we're talking about this frequently, so we don't need to beat a dead horse. But you see it in the prophets like Wittgenstein, for instance, and McLuhan and Postman, these prophets of the digital age saying this is going to happen or that's going to happen or this is going to happen. And lo and behold, 40 years later, it's happening. You're seeing that attention span loss, and you're seeing that that exposure to images that people didn't used to be exposed to. And you're seeing that being conditioned to push the buttons or to follow the need the device always with you. And you're also seeing this, as I said, this inability of a large majority of people to just be silent, to just be quiet. They need this constant stimulation, constant noise, constant chatter, so much so that when you see like YouTubers who vie for attention, especially for young kids, the more they yell, the more frenetic, the more they put forth gross or disgusting things, the more viewers they get. And so there's this sort of, I don't know what it is, an exponential kind of development of sound and noise and frenetic activity, as my friend Todd Mickelson used to say, a more frenetic world.
Yeah, I think that's, just to jump in here with that, that seems to me to be the outflow, I want to say fruit because fruit is a good thing, but I think the excrement of the reign of quantity. You know, as we switched over, so, you know, I think even going back to the 1880s or 1780s is the beginning, sort of, you know, sort of if we watch the march of sort of empiricism and the idea of things need to be quantifiable in order to be considered true, you know, is the slow evolution of science, which is to say the reduction of science to mere quantification of things.
Yeah.
As we get more and more to quantity, that's what makes digital technology possible. That's what makes mass production possible, is thinking in terms of quantity, numerical units of things, mass produced. It's that frame of mind that actually makes digital technology even possible, right? In fact, the French, you know, who always like to invent their own word for things instead of using the, you know, the common speech version of it, they can't say, you know, like, les technologies digitales, you know, in part because that just means fingers, right? So, I mean, the fingerly technology. The Italians are okay saying digitale, yeah. No,
yeah.
You know, they have no problem sounding weird when we talk here in Italy. But the French, you know, they say, well, what's really the equivalent here is numérique, numerical, right? Because that's what in English they mean by digital. There's a numerical technology. So we're identifying the numbers of things. I mean, it's all ones and zeros, right? I mean, that's kind of the basic framework for this. So naturally, if the goal is then more numbers, it doesn't matter numbers of what, but just sheer numbers, number of followers, number of likes, whatever, you know, decibels that I have to put on my video to get more likes. It's all quantity, quantity, quantity.
Yeah.
Quality at the gross expense of quality. And that actually is a highly developed or specific granular look at what at the root we see the fundamental contrast in this chapter, fire and water.
That's interesting. Yeah, I was thinking something along those lines too.
That's Bard versus the master of Lake Town.
Yeah, that's interesting. The two are juxtaposed against each other. You know, and mm-hmm. I wanted to look at the character of Bard first. I mean, he's descended from Geryon, or Geryon. Geryon was the king of the town of Esgaroth that was closer to the mountain. And when the dragon came, Geryon fled with his people that survived south and set up Lake Town. And so Bard is a descendant. I don't know how many generations descended from Geryon. Mm-hmm. But he has
something like 12 or 14,
is it
12? If I'm not mistaken. So I could be wrong on that, but that stands out in my mind.
Yeah.
I could be making that up. But
long enough that he did not himself know Geryon, and he himself was not familiar with the dragon as a immediate thing, rather just this mm-hmm. been passed down or whatever, the knowledge of the dragon. Yeah. And Bard is a character who has royal blood in him already. And we could, you know, we could talk about Tolkien's his political ideas. He seems to have been on the bent of royalist rather than democratic. He did not see it mm-hmm. a good idea necessarily. He wrote about how if he had to choose any political thing, it would be monarchy.
So yeah, in fact,
but
I was an interesting point about that, and I think one that strikes Americans particularly, but I think most modern people living in a liberal nation, liberal, I mean that in the classical sense of the word, that is to say a Republican or Democratic nation, it may strike them as odd, an odd combination, but Tolkien, there's a famous letter or something that he talks about his political leanings. He says, you know, I'm I suppose you could say I'm an anarchist.
Yes.
You know, not, you know, whiskered men throwing bombs, you know, this was popular in the turn of the century. You know, anarchist, and he explains further. He says, or maybe at best a monarchist. That anarchist and monarchist for him are much closer in the way. And he's speaking a very pithy, sort of short explanation in this letter. And I think that a lot of people see those as two fundamentally opposite things, because in a post-revolutionary world, we've been raised to think of monarchy as being the same as sort of absolute despotism or despotic absolutism. But for, you know, historically, it's simply not the case.
And no.
That's not the kind of monarchy. Tolkien's not talking about, you know, this Napoleon strong centralized despotic state.
Yeah.
You know, which he's talking about something much more free, much more decentralized, much more like perhaps we could say what the elves have, right? You've got a king, but everybody's kind of doing their own thing.
Yes.
Principally a judge.
Yes, and that's, again, you're right, the American mind is very locked against monarchism, and we fought our whole revolution against that idea, and we see here in America monarchists always as a negative, so that we react to the despotic and the tyrannical and the move towards monarchism. And certainly one could look at history and see that the tendency of a bad monarch to do a lot of damage is pretty bad. But on the flip side, the tendency of a badly influenced democracy, and I'm seeing this, by the way, more and more as I get older. I didn't used to see this at all. The tendency of a bad democracy, a democracy swayed towards, what do you call it? Chaos, anarchy, or swayed towards vice, can do just as much damage to individuals, if not more so, but maybe. So if, you know, in that sense, maybe Tolkien is right in being an anarchist. Maybe he is the extreme of what Madison said, that if, I think it was Madison, maybe Hamilton, if men were angels, no government would be necessary, right? If men were angels, it'd be great, because then we could say, no, we don't need government. We all govern ourselves. We all rule ourselves. And of course, Madison was saying that we aren't angels and therefore we need government. But maybe Tolkien was really an advocate for self-rule, autonomy, and working together towards a common goal, and not necessarily having to have these wheels of bureaucracy, these Kafka-esque wheels of bureaucracy, grinding everybody down.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. And I think that, you know, for Tolkien, the ideal for this then is that the king is, as he is, at least in the European context, and king or queen, it's worth pointing out that, you know, the Americans are really excited when, you know, a woman's on the ballot or something, maybe going to be on the ballot, maybe we'll for the first time get a woman elected president. Huh. Of course, never mind, many other civilized nations around the world have had women presidents and prime ministers for a long time now, yes, to say nothing of the long reigning Queen of England. But right, throughout history, the heads of, there have been many female heads of state. Like, this is, you know, it's not historically patriarchy and women are kept out. That's a relatively modern phenomenon. Obviously, every culture is different and things change over time, sort of cyclical patterns. So I would say king, I mean, king or queen, you know, a monarch is not then the head of a vast bureaucracy. You know, they're not the center of a vast bureaucracy. But for Tolkien, the ideal, and again, this is the European historical reality, is that the monarch's principal role then is to adjudicate conflicts, to adjudicate disputes, to preside over reconciling conflicts of his or her people.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's often a distributed thing down. It's not one sole power at the top and everybody's equally underneath that. But a king is just the person, or the king or queen is a person of most dignity or honor amongst a really loose confederation of smaller principalities, duchies, earldoms, and other fiefdoms of that sort.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a really good movie called The King's Choice, which is about the, is it Norwegian or Denmark? Danish, I got to look. Either the Danish or the Norwegian king who stood up to the Nazis in World War II when they invaded the country. And here's an old man, you know, his children are young, so they aren't ready to be able to handle the throne. And he has to make a decision. Does he stand up to the Nazis or does he bend over and allow them to roll over him? And he makes this decision to stand up to them, and he fights retreating the whole way until he finally has to flee the country. But it's this amazing movie about the nature of that role of monarch as leader and guide and example for how to behave. As well as just this incredible courage of this man to stand up to this juggernaut that was coming at him. It really harkens back to the image of the king, the Beowulfian image of the king as leading his people into the mouth of the dragon, you know, and standing up so that they don't have to face certain things. And I think in the ideal sense, that's what a kingship or queenship should be. Now, always the skeptic, always the American skeptic. We take into consideration the fact that in order to do that, kings have to do certain things and they have to engage in certain activities that maybe are dangerous or even immoral, perhaps you could say. I mean, that's what Machiavelli talks about, and it's what Thomas Paine talks about in his polemical writings. But nevertheless, in its ideal form, the monarch does have that role of providing a certain spiritual and moral example to a people that makes them better as a people.
Right.
And I think that even in America, we have a king, but we don't call him that.
Well, that's exactly it. You know,
the president, the executive branch, that plays the role of king, But it's not hereditary, and it's always checked by the two other branches in theory. And that's where I always have these questions, because in theory, this whole model works. In practice, not so much. Same thing with monarchs. In theory, in practice, we've got a lot of bad monarchs.
So right.
Hey, you've been more traveled than I have in this vein, and I don't remember. Italy has a democracy, right? And they don't. Is that what
Italy has a plutocracy?
Plutocracy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Italy has. Yeah. Officially, Italy is a republic that does not recognize the prerogatives of the nobility or of a monarchy, but it did not oust. Officially, it did not drive out and exile certain kinds of nobility. So they exist, but they have moral authority, perhaps, but most of them are not that, because there's a history that predates republicanism in that way, in terms of just massive civil wars across the peninsula here since the mid 1800s.
Right, right. And you never lived under the Greek king, right? I mean, I know that there's still a king in Greece, or there was until recently. So you never experienced that.
I did not, okay. And that's Greece is a particular situation, which is very interesting. I don't know enough about it. I know that Spain has a king, and has a whole royal family. Yes, that's something that's in the Anglophone world. We tend not to realize until there was, you know, nobody knew this until, you know, Catalonia. There was some separatist movement in Catalonia some, you know, a few years ago, maybe about 5-10 years ago, and you know, there was this big debate, you know, should Catalonia be, it's where Barcelona is, you know, should that be a separate thing? And all, you know, sort of, it was, you know, a lot of it is staged by the media, and then there's the real political stuff that's actually happening. But there was a royal decree issued by the King of Spain that, you know, something or other, you know, and it's kind of like, well, in other news, the whole Anglophone world just discovered there's a king in Spain, you know, like, but, and so he's got actual authority, you know, and not as much as perhaps in former days, but I think perhaps a bit more authority even than the monarchs of England do. Monarch of England does. Most of the Scandinavian countries also are still kingships.
Yeah.
You have Belgium as a kingdom. The Netherlands, for that matter, too. Mm. And of course, there's the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg and the Principality of Liechtenstein. Mm. The most of the Lord.
And I've got some friends, you know, I've got some friends here who are monarchists in their tendency, mm-hmm. which I've always found interesting. I don't completely dismiss it, but I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, America, our sense of monarchist is dictator, is totalitarian, this
right.
sort of thing. And so there's a sort of repugnance towards it. But at the same time, as Catholics, we're told that every person is called to be priest, prophet, and king. And that's always been something which I have to raise a quizzical eyebrow about. What first of all, why that terminology? And second, does it not, and it seems to have, caused conflict between Rome and Roman Catholicism, or European Catholicism, and America and American Catholicism? You know, American Catholicism would naturally rebel against that directive to be priest, prophet, and king. And I think American Catholicism would naturally gravitate towards a more democratic, let's vote on whether the Eucharist is really the body of Christ, you know, let's vote on this. That's the American thing. And of course, that's been slapped down since the 19th century with John Ireland and others.
Absolutely.
So why that terminology in the catechism that says every human should be priest, prophet, and king? Why that, I wonder? The priest and prophet, so the priest and prophet makes sense in the catechism, but the king part has always been interesting to me. What's meant by that? I think what's meant in the catechism, at least, and this may go back to the Tolkien thing, is that to be a priest means every individual is called, not to confect the sacraments, but every individual is called to basically be in touch with the holy, be in touch with the divine, to understand their place in the universe in relationship to God. So that's the priest part. Every prophet, every person is called to be a prophet in that every person, what do the prophets do? The prophets actually look at the state of things, and knowing human nature, they predict how something's going to happen. You know, prophets are not just like people that look at the bones of chickens and predict the future. Prophets are people that say, I know what human nature is. I know if we do this, this is going to hurt us. And so they see, if you continue doing this, this will happen. That's a prophet. So every person's called to that, sort of a conscience that is evoked in that. But the king part, I think that the catechism, you might have a different take on this, so let me know. I think the catechism is saying, every human being is called to be a leader, to be upright, and to have this ability to command others when necessary. Every person is called to do what is necessary in order to help the people that are put in their path. I think that's what is meant by being a king.
I just want to expand a little bit on that. And I think putting things on the right path is the great sort of, you know, the culmination launching point for understanding it. Is, and not to base everything off the etymology of one language, but let's just look at the Latin word for king,
right?
And that's rex or regis, rege, and queen, regina, just the feminine form of the noun. But the word rex, you know, has its origins and very explicitly in the Romance languages is like, is to rectere, to rectify, to put things recto, which is to put things right. Like the king in its fundamental conception in Europe, and this is related to the other, I mean, there's something similar in both the Greek language and in the Semitic languages that doesn't mean this, it's not the exact same word, doesn't have the exact same connotations, but it helps us understand by looking at the Latin concept, the sort of the Greco-Roman, that's to say the European worldview, the mindset of what a king is then, is somebody who sets things right. And so if as an individual, I am called to be, in fact, I am consecrated, each one of us, you know, according to the Christian ritual, each one of us is consecrated at our baptism to be priest, prophet, and king. Each one of us is consecrated then to put things right.
Is right.
In those dominions that are under our authority, under our responsibility, under our authorship, whether that is as a single individual, that's your own life, your job, your room, your house, your garden, as a family, as the head of a family, your parents, you know, husband and wife have the responsibility to put right the things in their household, get their household in order, and those who then have responsibility over a larger extended family, so the patriarch or matriarch of an extended family, such as we see the traditional family, outside of the Anglosphere, very common, especially in Hispanic countries or Mediterranean countries, to make sure that things go right for their children, grandchildren, and you know, all the aunts and uncles of the whole tribe. And if you have responsibility for a town or a city because you are the leading person there, now that's a way, you know, then you become all of a sudden the one who sets things right in the city. And pretty soon we're talking about the king of a city or the queen of a city.
I like that. I like that very much. I mean, certainly, I mean, first off, my handle is Abecedarius Rex, which, you know, hard for everybody to spell, but no one else on that's going to have that handle. But
right.
The idea of Rex, of setting it right, of having to rectify that situation, that's a very important insight, I think. Because not only does it mean that each individual is called to set things right, it also means that each individual has a moral obligation to find out what is the right, to find out what that standard is. You can't go around saying, I'm truth fluid, you know.
this is my truth, your truth, my truth, two truths.
Right? Your truth over there in Italy, my truth over here. No, there's truth. And if you have a knowledge of that, you are able to lead other people. There's a great line out of the book Rumblefish by S.E. Hinton, which is made a fantastic movie by Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola. And there's a line in there where Motorcycle Boy, who is the king in exile, so to speak, he says to his brother, if you're going to lead people, you have to have somewhere to go. And his tragedy is he doesn't know where to lead people, right? That's the tragedy of the book. And I encourage people to read. It's a great book. But that line's always stuck with me. If you're going to lead people, you have to have somewhere to go. It means you have to have a vision of what's right. And that doesn't mean micromanage, right? But it means that you have, look, we're humans. This is how the human machine works. If you put sugar in the gas tank, it's not going to work. It's that
simple. Right.
And so the king is the one who has the right vision. And this is why I think in our story, the image of Bard as the inheritor of the line of kings is so appropriate because, of course, it's not the master of the town, which is kind of Tolkien's maybe not so subtle commentary. Look, this profiteering, this making of dough, this mechanical bourgeois way of looking at the world is not the right course. And maybe the right course is to, on the one hand, recognize that we're greater than that, but also recognize that eventually we're going to face a dragon.
Yeah.
What's the response of the king to the dragon versus the response of the master to the dragon?
Right.
The master gets in his boat and flees.
Right. Right. He's literally just an employee, right? He's a public employee. He's a public servant. He's paid for his job. He's paid well. He makes money for the town and plenty for himself. And so naturally he seeks to preserve that, which is his function, which is that middleman, middle manager kind of stuff.
Yes.
Whereas Bard, who has, he's got a very kingly character, even though he has no tangible power.
Yeah.
In fact, he seems to be kind of bottom of the pyramid in the town society. People are always, you know, he seems like kind of a Debbie Downer about a lot of things. You know, as the crowd is quick to label him, you know, because he's always saying it's going to be, you know, poisoned fish or this, that, or the other disaster. But really what he's doing is trying to protect these people, right, to look out for the good. And so when they all get all excited and see the flashing lights, they see the discotheque thing coming down the river. Hey, the gold is coming, baby. Here's the money. It's the metaverse. And he says, cut the bridges. This is this is a dragon. We gotta prepare and fight back.
That's a good analogy, isn't it? Where everybody else is going after the centripetal bumble puppy, as G.K. called it. Bard is the guy who says, wait, the centripetal bumble puppy is made out of asbestos. You don't want to be eating it, right?
Right.
The urinal cake.
Free mints.
Do what I want. You're not my dad. And it's intriguing when you look at even the name of the guy. You know, I'm looking at the origins here, just of the dictionary. This comes, the word bard comes from a Gaelic word that's related to, it's an Anglo-Saxon word originally, which means singer, right? One who sings. Mm-hmm. And there's something I think at the Tolkien Gateway about, I don't know what it is, about bard is something related to beard. Like facial hair. Yeah, maybe. I don't know if that's what he was going for.
I don't think that's true. In fact, there's an old Saxon word for like knight or warrior that is, I mean, this is something in like Gawain and the Green Knight or maybe the Wanderer, you know, where they use multiple different, like what are all the synonyms for this kind of, you know, role? Because you have to make the alliteration work and everything in Anglo-Saxon poetry. And I was just listening to this thing, and I think that there's a word that sounds similar to that.
Yes.
That I believe that he's hearkening to a word that is at once is sort of the Anglo-Saxon, Old English, or whatever dialect, I don't know, but something to do with a word for a grim warrior, a knight, a king, a prince, chieftain, something like this. In fact, I think similarly, we have the word bairn.
Yeah.
In some dialects of English, you know, that means a boy, but it's related to the sense of a man, right? You know, that kind of thing. But I think you're right to point out the Gaelic connection as well, because what is a bard in the sense that we think of a bard as a poet, a singer, something like this, is their function in really early Celtic society was that of a prophetic, was a prophetic nature, right? They speak for the gods, but they can also, in their singing, And of course, the Anglo-Saxon word of like a story is to say a spell, right? To cast a spell. There's an enchantment in singing, which is what the word enchantment means anyway. That there's a magic that can be woven in their speech, and they can affect then the outcome of, say, a battle for something.
Absolutely, yes. Affect the outcome of a battle. That the ability of somebody to galvanize the mentality of a person so they can accomplish a task. I remember when we used to play soccer. It was just kind of like battle. We did not play like Michael Bolton music. We would crank the AC/DC or the U2 or the Megadeth. Because it was an attempt to get you ready to get out there and take on whatever it was you had to take on. And I think even now, when you look at something great, an art like a movie or a music or a painting, whatever it is, or even read a novel like we're doing, it ends up galvanizing the mind to be able to accomplish a task. And if that task is as tremendous as shooting a dragon, you better get some damn good art before you face that, right? You're not gonna make it if all you've ever seen is like My Little Pony, although My Little Pony's
Or Jackson Pollock.
or Jackson Pollock, right?
Just meaninglessness, right?
What does
It's just
it do for you?
chaos.
There's an interesting twist on this too, just in the dictionary entry. This is a 15th century word borrowed from Gaelic, but it's akin to an Albanian word, grisha, which means invited to a wedding, invited to a wedding.
A wedding
Because, of
guest.
course, the bard would be, he'd be the entertainment. But more than that, he'd be giving voice to what was actually happening. This is a sacred event. This is an event where, you take on a sort of not chronological time, but chaotic time. You enter into another realm. And so he helps people to enter into another realm of thought and of being as well through that singing that he does. The word, by the way, which you were thinking of, and I did luck onto this, I went and looked at one of my resources is called Behind the Name. A great website, because they any name that you want to find out, they pretty much have. And so I looked up Bard, and the name Bard here behind the name comes from an Old Norse word, which makes perfect sense. This is Tolkien all over. The name Bardr, which was derived from elements bardu, battle, and friðr, peace. Okay? So friðr is peace. Bardu is battle. It can mean warlike, like you were saying, warlike. So that word bard is probably far more somebody who sings a person into battle, right? Sings them into battle. Which I love. My Celtic origins rise up at this because, of course, the first thing that comes to mind for me is bagpipes, right? And that image of moving into battle with that sound all around you. We've always had soundtracks as humans from as far back as
Oh,
the
goodness.
Mesopotamians. We had music playing whatever event we were doing. But that image of marching into battle with that sound, like the paean of the Spartan, for instance, or we were listening to Gustav Holst this morning, the Mars, the bringer of war. That thing that just gets you so you're ready to do this otherwise impossible deed is something which I think in our modern entertainment industry, it's hard to reconcile with. When you have Christina Aguilera, she doesn't really get you ready to go into battle too much, unless
No,
it's
she's trying to get you ready for other things.
a repugnant response to Christina Aguilera, maybe. I'm a kid. But yeah, the name Bard then reckons back to this Bardu, which is the battle man, and not just a König who is a giver of rings. The König was the giver of. He is somebody who has in him the ability to lead and to galvanize others and to encourage them in doing something which is tremendous. So yeah, good stuff to talk about. That the dragon that they're facing too, Smaug, there's a lot of destruction that Smaug causes. I thought that was an interesting thing to touch on. How much does Smaug end up destroying Dale, this modern city of commerce?
Or,
Pretty much destroys it all. I mean, there's not much.
All of Askarov is gone. He's able to. So that's, I mean, that's something that's remarked at the end of the chapter. Essentially, that, you know, the major, thanks to Bard, essentially, the majority of the people did not die.
Right.
But they lost everything they, and their precious belongings that they have, you know, perhaps a few things. The, you know, what do you grab in the house when it's on fire? That kind of deal. But the whole town and their homes are destroyed.
Yeah. So the civilization is ruined, but the people survive.
Right, because he had the bridges cut and thrown down. So the dragon could normally, the way the dragon would attack, if you know something about dragon tactics here, the dragon would attack by landing on the ground and then running across the bridge, and he could rampage through the town, weaving through like a serpent, because he's not visible. He's not as visible as when he's hovering up above. Everybody can shoot at him then.
Yeah.
He can sneak through and burn and really rapaciously run through and among the people, right? If we can think about the imagery of this, or the metaphorically how a dragon spirit can run through a people and make them, you know, you get an angry mob very quickly, becomes like a destructive dragon, shooting, burning down, blowing up stuff.
Just
CF Minneapolis.
Yeah, right. Stores,
like, you know, that kind of thing. That's far more destructive than if there's a dragon sort of spirit hovering over and attacking from outside.
Good point.
Right. So Bard was able to prevent this from entering in and among the people.
Yeah.
In and of itself. And so the people were able to flee. And also then, you know, the author tells us here too, or the narrator tells us that the dragon's plan, sure, let the people all get into their boats. That's fine. I'll just torch the shoreline where all their fields and all their livestock are, and I can watch them float out there and starve to death.
Yeah, and I can pick them off.
You know, he can wait.
There's an interesting part in there, too, where he talks about how he could separate them all and then pick them off one by one. I don't remember which. Let's see if I can find it really quickly. Here it is. It says, already men were jumping into the water on every side. Women and children were being huddled into laden boats in the market pool. Weapons were flung down. There was mourning and weeping. Where but a little time ago, the old songs of mirth to come had been sung about the dwarves. Now men cursed their names. The master himself was turning to his great gilded boat, hoping to row away in the confusion and save himself. Soon all the town would be deserted and burned down to the surface of the lake. That was the dragon's hope. They could all get into boats for all he cared. There he could have fine sport hunting them, or they could stop till they starved. Let them try to get to land, and he would be ready. Soon he would set all the shoreland woods ablaze and wither every field and pasture. It's a great image, too, because part of the element of the dragon is this connection to the demonic, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember a great speech by Fulton Sheen at one point. I think it's called The Demonic or The Diabolic, where he points out that one of the words for the demonic is diabolos, the diabolane, which, as he says, is a tearing apart, rending asunder. And so part of the way the demonic works is that it tears people apart that should otherwise be united to one another.
Exactly.
Once they're isolated, you isolate and then you remove them, basically. They're easier targets when they are alone and they are frightened and don't move.
Yeah.
When they're united together, not to bring the conversation down, but when they're united together, it's like that scene out of Bug's Life, right? We're stronger than we think, and you know it, you know. The ants unite them. There goes our way of life. Because otherwise, as humans, as individuals, we do have a tendency to think, oh, we're all alone. No one thinks the way that I do. I must be a freak. The world's going to hell in a handbasket. I can do nothing about it. I just should sit here and, you know, cower. And we end up getting picked off one by one. In our unity, we are able to stand up much more than when we are isolated. But exactly. I can walk.
And precisely. And even when the dragon is killed and falls full on the town, destroying it, there's still that risk, as we see at the very end of the chapter and into what comes for a short bit, is there's the temptation of the people who've all suffered this tragedy then to turn on each other, to begin to turn on the dragon, to not the dragon, but they want to scapegoat somebody. We have to sort of offload this onto somebody.
Yeah.
And we see the master actually essentially turning against, I mean, he turns against Bard right away until it becomes inconvenient for him. It becomes, you know, awkward for him when Bard shows up again. You know, but then he, you know, we see the subtle comments that Tolkien gives that, you know, the master, you know, not everybody had a blanket, but the master got one. But everybody had to go, everybody had, you know, very little food to go around. Even the master went a little short, you know, like he just says the master made sure he had a tent. He had a blanket. He made sure he had enough food, but he went a little short. But, you know, he's looking out for himself because people in these kinds of circumstances either become generous and altruistic or they become very centered. There's very, very little middle ground.
Yes.
In these kinds of circumstances. But Bard galvanizes them together. And the first thing he does is start to look for opportunities to serve the people, to bring them together, to work towards a new common project of building up at least sort of the temporary shanty town, and ultimately to make their way to the mountain.
That's a really good, that's a really good observation right there too. Do you remember a few years ago when Hurricane Katrina hit Louisiana and the dikes burst basically? There are all these reports of cannibalism and people turning against each other and blah 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 blah, and as and it was horrifying, right? We were like, God, human beings are terrible. But then as the truth came out, it turned out it was quite the opposite, that normal people were helping each other. The National Guard was out there rescuing folks. People were giving up whatever they had to help everybody else around them. It was really very, I think it was a very important moment in American history to show how human beings could bond together in a time of crisis. But the, the amazing thing was that the politicians were the ones who were really driving the story of cannibalism and pointing fingers at each other and, you know, from their posh apartments there in Washington, D.C., saying basically it's so-and-so's fault or whatever, and not taking any blame and not going down there to help either. It was really, it was a real Bard moment, you know, a real Dale moment there. And I think that's happened frequently in our recent history, where good, average, normal people have bonded together and started to recognize that the masters are not who we thought they were, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. They see, and all of a sudden it becomes revealed. You know, the master is, you know, where do they, people started claiming, down with Moneybags, up with Bard the Bowman.
Yeah.
We've had enough of old guys, old politicians who are seeking after money. It's like, wow. Yeah. Shoot, you know, that doesn't ring true.
I mean, did you recently see in the January 6th, have you followed the January 6th hearings at all? Have you
No,
I haven't. Ted Cruz was grilling an agent of the FBI and asking her whether or not there were FBI agents among the crowd. And of course, she dodged the question over and over and over again. But apparently, there's some good evidence that there were FBI agents incognito in the crowd, stirring the crowd up to violence, you know, and even providing some tools for them to commit violence on January 6th. That was the FBI doing that.
Sure.
That was my,
That's right out of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I know, no kidding. It was really, it was pretty stunning. Back when we had the riots here, that little altercation that we had, There were shady individuals walking around. I remember one with an umbrella and a mask and wearing all black. And he was going around, just walking around. He wasn't doing anything, but he was walking around, obviously giving orders to other people. That was shady, right? Or down in Dallas, I remember somebody posted a video, some kid posted a video of stacks of bricks that had been left out on the street, like pallets of bricks that had been left out.
Very conveniently.
Yep. Yeah, you're not going to get us this time, you know. You got to be smarter than that. But it was a moment where suddenly realized the masters are not who we thought they were. You know, the masters go out for their own good, not for the good of the people.
Right.
I think in this instance, Bard is the character who not only rallies the people and saves them from this imminent threat, as you said, the serpent, the dragon, the worm moving among the people. But he also ends up being the killer of the serpent. The killer of the serpent.
Exactly.
And not with sword or spear, as is the traditional way. Because the dragon killing stories, we have a warrior who kills with a sword. You know, like Fafnir gets killed when he passes over Siegfried underneath him with a sword. here, and even Glaurung, I think Glaurung in the Silmarillion, I think Glaurung is killed by means of sword too. Here we have an arrow, and I find that intriguing. Bard the Bowman kills him while he flies over. And let's just look at that passage really quick and see when he kills the dragon. This is, okay, here we go. Suddenly, he bent his bow for the last time, it says. Suddenly out of the dark, something fluttered to his shoulder. He started, but it was only an old thrush. Unafraid, it perched by his ear and it brought him news. Marveling, he found he could understand its tongue, for he was of the race of Dale. So here's this moment where it's like, oh, I didn't know that I could understand birds like Siegfried does after he has the blood of Fafnir. Mm-hmm. But suddenly he can understand the bird. And so the bird becomes this messenger from Bilbo, basically. And it says, wait, wait, it said to him, the moon is rising. Look for the hollow of the left breast as he flies and turns above you. Why does the bird bother saying the moon is rising? What do you make of that? That's kind of an interesting little tidbit. Like, you have to tell the guy, oh, there's a hollow in the left breast, but first I'll tell you, hey, the moon's rising.
Right.
What, bird? What? But I think that that image of the moon rising and the bird saying that is very similar to the imagery of the keyhole that we get earlier, the last slide of the setting
sun. Right.
The moon rising is sort of like, this is the magic about to happen. You're about to fit the key into the keyhole. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
It's just that
there's all of a sudden light to see by, or light to become obscured by the dragon, and
right.
You can see clearly then the shot. But there's something that luminous, something luminous is coming out.
Yes.
You're not in the darkness anymore.
Yes, yes, yes. That's a key image in Tolkien over and over again, all the way into Lord of the Rings. Light is not just mechanical operations. You know, it is when the sun rises or when the moon rises. There's something divine happening, some illumination occurs. And that illumination takes other forms too, like the file of Galadriel against Shelob later on, or the moment that Frodo sees the last light falling on the crown of flowers around the fallen king's head. Those images of light in darkness are something which is crucial to Tolkien. So here we have the moon is rising. It's not just the bird is just some Twitter-pated avian thing, is that this is part of the magic. The light is coming back, the real light is coming back, and this is the moment that you have to do this thing. So it tells him, here's the...
Right.
And then it told him of the tidings up in the mountain and of all that it had heard. So there's a long narrative we don't get here where the bird recites to Bard everything that it has seen. Which is kind of amusing, but also, you know, because in the middle of battle, you get this narrative by a bird, you know. But at the same time, it makes sense that here's the messenger, an angelic almost messenger, that comes down and tells him, this is the moment. This is what I've seen. This is what you need to know. Like in a flash, boom, here's your marching order, right? And then Bard has action. Then Bard drew his bowstring to his ear. So immediately he goes into action. He understands what the bird is saying, and he immediately does what is necessary. He's not like, oh, wait a minute, you're just a bird. Or maybe
he doesn't stop and say, wait a minute, did I just talk to a bird?
I just talked to a bird. You know, am I going insane? No, he immediately has this action based on what he has heard from the divine source.
Mm-hmm.
The dragon was circling back, flying low. And as he came, the moon rose above the eastern shore and silvered his great wings.
Well,
that's a great image.
Silvered his great wings.
Yeah.
There's a silver lining to every dragon. You know?
There's a silver lining to every dragon. Good. Good for you. There's a moment where this horrifying dragon is illuminated by the divine light and made, I would say, beautiful. There's a moment where it's beautiful. Because remember,
it's beautiful.
He's got gems all over his belly, right? That's why he's impervious. It's because the soft parts of a worm are normally under the belly, but here he's got gems encrusted all over him like a waistcoat, and that makes him impervious. But when the moon shines on him, he's silvered in the wings, but he glows. His whole belly glows, which is amazing. It's like the Red Wheelbarrow, right, by Carlos Williams, that for a moment, the wheelbarrow is lit up by the rainwater and becomes something quasi-divine.
Yeah.
Similar thing here. The wheelbarrow of Smaug is lit up for a moment by this moonlight. It becomes something beautiful. Yeah.
And except for one place, there's a dark spot.
Yeah.
So just to name a few things here that I see, and I don't know what to do with them, but the moon is rising. Bard is no longer in the darkness, but a dark thrush comes to him to speak into his ear. And then he pulls his black arrow back and shoots into the darkness that's in the heart of the beast.
Mm.
So he's got the beast is illuminated by the moon and the reflection from the fires below, in which Bard is standing in the midst of these flames. And he pulls back his black arrow and shoots into the dark spot, which is the heart of the beast.
Yeah.
You know, we've got this contrast between bright and dark, lightness and black, you know, bright and black, lightness and darkness, and dark to dark and light to light. And here Bard is suspended between heaven and earth, and his world is perishing in fire and water, right? The city is a microcosm of the world. He is perishing in fire and in water. And then here he is suspended and he shoots a thing. Right, an arrow that then itself hovers in between the heavens and the earth. It flies through and then smote, what does it say? The black arrow sped straight from the string, straight for the hollow in the left breast, where the foreleg was flung wide.
Mm.
It smote and vanished, barb, shaft, and feather. So fierce was its flight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great, I mean, I love the way Tolkien writes that little section of it vanished barb, shaft, and feather. You get an image of that arrow, not just piercing it, but like going right in and all the way in.
Right in. Yeah.
Heart of the dragon. It's a great image. And your point about it being held, what's called liminally held, held between heaven and earth, that moment of suspension, which is, by the way, the same suspension as the crucifixion, isn't it? That, you know, held between heaven and earth. But it's at that moment that he releases that arrow that then ends up destroying the thing that's trying to wipe out his civilization. It's a great, great image. And he talks to the arrow first. Why does he talk to the arrow? This is an interesting passage. He says, directed to the arrow, "Arrow, black arrow, I have saved you to the last. You have never failed me, and always I have recovered you. I had you from my father and he from of old. If ever you came from the forges of the true king under the mountain, go now and speed well." So just in that little passage, there's a lot to unpack. I mean, the fact that he's talking to the arrow, that's remarkable. The arrow has a consciousness. And talking to the arrow. And you could take it as a sort of a magical spell or even just as a ceremony, but I think it's better.
It's a benediction, right? Benediction, he's putting a good word on it.
Right.
That's the word benediction means. He's putting a good word.
Yeah.
He's speaking goodness into it. He's speaking effectiveness into it. And then shooting it. And you're right. It's something, it has a life, if not a consciousness, but something where it's not just molecules.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not just dead matter.
Yeah.
Moreover, it's wood. An arrow was made of wood and stone and feather.
Yep.
So it's or wood and metal and feather. So wood, mineral, feather,
and
plant, animal, vegetable, and mineral all combined in one thing.
And so it
combines these elements and it flies through the air to get to the final, you know, wrap up.
And it's forged, right? It's not something
you
have to buy by a fletcher, right?
Right.
A maker of arrows. It's forged under the mountain by dwarves. So it's got dwarvish involved in it as well. And it has a history where he has shot it before, for whatever reason, I don't know, to hunt deer or whatever, but he's shot it before and then recovered it. And it's not going to recover it here. It says later that he lost the black arrow, but he's shot it before. And so he says, you know, you've always been my last line of defense, my greatest tool, my companion, if you will, in hunting. It reminds me a lot the scene out of Private Ryan, Saving Private Ryan, where the sniper, right before he shoots, is saying this prayer, right? He's praying the Psalms, you know, "You are my might, you are my strength, you are my right arm, fail me not, O Lord," you know, that kind of thing. And then he takes his shot. It's a similar type of thing, speaking into existence the effectiveness of this tool. And why, this is something which Tolkien's always good with colors, I gotta say. His colors and use of color is not quite Stephen Crane, you know, as he does in the Red Badge of Courage. But nevertheless, he's always using colors to effect. So here he has the black arrow, like the black thrush. Why does he have that color for the arrow? Why isn't it like the green arrow or the blue arrow or something like that? It's this color of the underworld, right? Of a world of the subconscious almost. Black being the color of night and of sleep and of dreams. And he's shooting the creature out of nightmare using a tool of dreams itself.
As a bard.
Yeah. As a singer, as a bard, as one who sings into existence things. There is, of course, there's the Robert Louis Stevenson story, right? Which I'm sure he was familiar with. It's called The Black Arrow. You know, you don't have to wonder, well, what's the name of the story? It's The Black Arrow by Robert Louis Stevenson. Great story. And made into, there's like four or five versions of it, too, if I remember right, which are fun to watch as movies. But there, the Black Arrows, that's not just the name of the arrow, it's the name of one of the major characters, too. But why that color? That's an interesting thing that he brings up.
It is, isn't it?
Why would he have it as the last thing to take on this creature of blackness and darkness?
And in shooting it, successfully slaying the dragon, it also spells the destruction of their town, of their world.
Yes.
To slay the dragon means also then to their whole town will be just their whole, the last vestiges of their world are destroyed with the dragon. And so in that way, you see these things crashing together, the dragon, the demonic, the diabolical, which has been assaulting the town. To slay the dragon means also this thing must fall down onto it, sort of like the ceiling of the heavens coming crashing down, and the whole thing, dragon and city and bard, become plunged into the water.
Yeah. Well,
and there's the fire and the water meet together there, and it's the end of the dragon and of Escaroth, but not of Bard.
Right.
He's reborn again from the primordial waters, but we've created primordial waters again here. The collapse of the elements all together. And in order perhaps to save the city, sometimes the city itself has to, it has to be remade, which means it has to be melted down, essentially. You know, it's destroyed in the process.
Well, Tolkien would have been very familiar with the whole image in Norse mythology of Ragnarok.
Right, sure.
Ragnarok was the image for the Norse of the destruction of the world. And for the kids out there, the Thor movie of Ragnarok is fun, but it doesn't really get the story, okay? That's not really what the story is. The story is of what's called in German the Götterdämmerung, the last conflict of the gods, this huge cataclysm where human beings are kind of wrapped up in a much larger struggle. And that's a struggle between the gods of consciousness, who are the Norse Asgardians, and then the gods, if you will, the demons, the monsters of dark chaos, most of whom actually are the progeny of Loki, but like Fenris and like, but also other creatures like the giants, right, the Jotunheim, and other creatures like the spiders who are just there. And so when they have this huge conflict that occurs, the conflict is one where humans are involved in this huge struggle. In fact, great warriors are saved and taken up to Valhalla to later on fight in the battle. But the gods lose in Ragnarok. All the gods are destroyed. Asgard is torn down and burned, and all of the humans are wiped out, except for two. And this is another element of the Ragnarok, which is often overlooked. At the end of this, two humans emerge from the battle, and they start up the human race again in a world now without gods, strangely enough. So Ragnarok is the end of the world for the Norse, but it's also the beginning of the world. Everything is reconstructed. So much the same way here, you know, the old way of doing things, which is the commercial way of the master and the barter and trade and things, that's gone. That's going to change with the dragon.
Right.
And in some ways it's necessary for it to be destroyed so the dragon could be killed.
Exactly.
But I see the same image come up later in Lord of the Rings, right?
Mm-hmm.
The destruction of Mordor and of Sauron means the destruction of the old way. They even say that this is now moving into the next age of
Right.
Middle-earth. And Galadriel says that when you destroy the ring, this is the march of doom for us. For everything we've created here will be destroyed too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's very aware and repeats that image in Lord of the Rings. He's very aware that the salvation, if you will, recreation of our life in some ways has to involve the destruction of the old way. You destroy the old man to put on the new, as Paul said.
Exactly. The seed has to fall into the ground and die in order to produce grain abundantly. And I think that's, yeah, it's exactly right. This element here that when we see the dragon coming, we must know that in order to slay the dragon, it likely will spell the destruction of our own city.
Yes, and be ready for
it. Which is a exactly, to be ready for that. Like Bard was ready for that and willing to take the shot, knowing full well this thing is going to fall full on the town. Not to cling to the burning embers, saying, no, we could maybe rebuild it from what it is. You have to let it go, dive into the water so that it can be reborn again.
Well, because the alternative, of course, is the master, right? It's the counterbalance to Bard. The master is the other way of responding to this cataclysm, which is to flee and leave everybody behind in a cowardly
cling
way. Die in the wasteland, gnawing on your gold, right? As it said.
Right. That's the only alternative.
Yeah. You become Grendel. You become the Grendelian.
Yes.
Alone.
Right. Yeah. Grabber, gnawer.
Right, exactly. And I think that it's also significant that you said the seed, unless the seed fall into the ground and die, here we have the seed falling into the water.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when Smaug dies, he says he falls full on the town. Like there, maybe we can save some of the town. Oh, guess not.
No. Whole thing gone.
So much for that catastrophic loss. But catastrophic loss, and the most important things, which is the women, the old people, the little babies, they survive. That's really significant.
That's exactly right.
I also like here with Tolkien that he's bringing up what's called a cosmogony, which is a creation of the universe. Mm-hmm. Cosmogonical things are when you have a creation of the universe, it's normally signified by battle and blood, but also with these chthonic forces, these elemental forces that struggle with each other, like fire and water and lightning and earth. And there's a great scene like in the Iliad where Achilles goes and he battles the river itself in his madness, and this cosmogonical image of fighting these huge forces, these titanic forces. Here you've got fire and water, which are the two, not just the two titanic forces for our Greek mythology, but they are the fundamental forces for Norse mythology. In the beginning of all Norse mythology, there are two things. There's fire and there's ice, water. And it's out of the mixture of those two things that the first creatures emerge. So you've got a similar image. Fire, the dragon from on high, falls into the water. And the water, there's a hiss and a gushing whirl and then silence. The water extinguishes him.
Right.
So not only was he shot directly in the heart, but he's completely extinguished and engulfed. Overwhelmed, as the word is, a whelm is a wave.
Mm-hmm.
He's overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And that was the end of him. And in the same sentence, it's the end of Smaug and Escaroth, but not of Bard. Because both the city that's on the water, that's an interesting image, I never thought of that. The city that's on the water, that is a city that's lived by a sort of fluidity of existence, right?
Mm.
Prayed mm-hmm. water. They are civilization fluid.
Right.
And that's so they right. And suddenly that's destroyed by fire. Which again, civilization is civilizationally fluid when it's willing to compromise its ideals to make money. And it seems relatively stable because you're living on a lake. What's going to happen on a lake? Nothing ever happens on a lake. And so we've trucked along for so long, trading with everybody and making tons of money. We don't reckon with the possibility of war or of destruction, which is the fire element. And suddenly the fire element comes and it destroys our civilization and is engulfed by the fluidity of water. And the only salvation is that there is somebody like Bard who not only destroys that fire element, but he also brings us back out again afterwards.
Right.
How interesting is that?
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, and what's interesting is that the chapter doesn't, you know, it doesn't end just with like, okay, and that's nice and they're out. Oh, good. You know, whew, we made it. We lost some things, but we'll be all right. There is good at the end. We're told something else comes from outside, and the elves are going to come and help. But Bard comes up and he emerges from the water.
Oh yeah,
and it's actually there's an interesting thing psychologically. This is the first time he identifies himself. We're told that he is the his name is Bard. He's a descendant from the long line of Geryon, kings of Dale. Right. That's why he can understand the speech of birds. But it's only after he reemerges from the waters that he says, I am Bard of the line of Geryon. I am the slayer of the dragon. He has a new identity now. He's not just the grim-faced captain of the archers. He's not just the guy who's prophesying, you know, poisoned fish and bad water.
Yep.
But he is now Bard, son of the kings, and the slayer of the dragon.
Yes.
But he stands and he starts to get things organized. But we're told in an almost parenthetical way that it's not over when the catastrophe is over. There are wounds that are not necessarily visible that people can still die from. And we're told that many people took ill of wet and cold and sorrow that night, and afterwards died who had escaped uninjured from the ruin of the town. And in the days that followed, there was much sickness and great hunger. Then in such times of disaster, as we see regularly in the news, you know, after a big natural disaster or something, you know, these kinds of things, we know that they're there, but I think we can often overlook them when it's just on the telly. You could just turn it off or change the channel because the big event is over. I don't need to, okay, whatever, you know, people, it's still rough, whatever, you move on. But when those catastrophes and disasters happen to you, I think it's an important and galvanizing thing to keep in mind that there's a long, tough slog ahead.
Yep.
And I think it's those who are aware that there is going to be the cold and the wet and the hunger and the sickness are more likely to survive it than those that think that it's all over now and that when the cold and wet and the sickness come, they give up and die.
Yeah, interesting story on that. I'm just reflecting on this. You know, We're over 20 years since 2001, the catastrophe that happened on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that was one of several, but it was a life-changing event for me. And it was for many other people that lived through it or even saw it, you know, soon after. And before that event, there was a movie called Fight Club, which I'm not supposed to talk about, but I'm going to anyway.
That's right.
The end of which I won't give away entirely, but it's very similar to the event happening in 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the gist of the movie was this capitalist thing can't go on. This bourgeois way of living can't go on. It has to experience some kind of Ragnarok.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, a few years after that, there was a Ragnarok there in New York. And it was tremendous. And it was horrifying. And for quite some time after that, maybe 2-3 years after that, I thought, this is going to galvanize us. This is going to change our way of thinking. This is going to have effects on people that will suffer for years after as well. And certainly it galvanized my thinking in a certain way. And it may, you know, one could argue that it split our nation into two polar camps or something. But we have, since that time, 20 years ago, our society has changed radically. One can say for the better, for the worse. And it's those people who recognize that this wasn't over right afterwards, who recognize something had to be done, to change their own lives, to change the world around them. Those are the people that were able to create new things, better things, lead us in the right direction. The people that try to go back to the normal before that, or try to reboot the system, were the same people that led us up to 2007 and the market crash that occurred then, you know, because they thought everything was just the same as it was before. And it's not. The dragon hit us in 2001. And now we have to worry about what world do we live in after that event? Because, yeah, that's the big question. It's a big question of freedom, too, which Tolkien is wonderful for. All of his works speak of freedom to some degree. And he is always keen on the idea, not just of, yay, ding dong, the witch is dead. He's always keen on the idea of, what do you do after that freedom is
granted right
to you?
That's exactly right. Things can't go on as before.
No.
We can't simply remake, but we do have to rebuild.
Yes.
But recognizing that it's a different world. And it's true of every epochal shift that happens in society or even worldwide.
Yeah.
That the world is not the same as it was before. And to wish that it were, like, actively, or to be hung up on trying to play act that it is not, it means to not be able to move forward.
Right.
Or even the people of Lake Town move eventually, or sort of projected into the future a bit. You know, we're told that they eventually rebuild further northward, higher up the shore, where they avoided the place where the dragon lay in the water, essentially. But before we get from, you know, from the present moment to that distant future when the town is rebuilt, we see that, you know, the elven army comes along to help out and succor them in their need.
Yes.
But they pretty quickly get everybody who's able, every able-bodied person, to move up and in 11 days march, pass into the rock gates at the end of the lake, into the desolate lands of the dragon's abode.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that same image is, it's kind of like that return to the Shire at the end of The Lord of the Rings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You come back and you find that the Shire has been altered, this thing that you thought was so beautiful. And now you're freedom to either say, well, we'll just live with the dark satanic mills and Sharky,
right,
or we're going to do something about it and fix this. You know, what's the word we were using earlier, right? That the king, one who rectifies.
To set things right. Yeah.
We're going to set this right.
Right.
And there you have to, you would, Tolkien wouldn't do this, but, you know, you have to contend with people that say, well, wait a minute, Sharky's doing a good job. I'm making tons of money, you know, and this is a...
Right. He's introduced them to industry. He brought them out of the Middle Ages.
Yeah. Brought us out of those dark periods of time we had before when we did nothing but build churches. Yeah, I love the speech that the master gives here after the people realize here's Bard. He's, you know, Bard has come back from this baptism by fire and water, and... Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, I am of the line of Gurion. I'm the slayer of the dragon. And everybody's like, yeah, let's make you king, make you king. The master of the lake town, which, by the way, I see a lot of parallels. The word master itself is definitely hearkening towards, or foreshadowing or whatever, the master of the ring, you know, the lord of the ring. It's an image. Yeah. But here it says, Gurion was lord of Dale, not king of Escadoth. In the lake town, we have always elected masters from among the old and wise, and have not endured the rule of mere fighting men. Talk about, you know, rhetoric twisting the arm.
There's a battle of identities here.
Yeah.
Who gets to label who?
The spin doctor here, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Let King Bard go back to his own kingdom. Dale is now freed by his valor, and nothing hinders his return, and any that wish can go with him if they prefer the cold stones under the shadow of the mountain to the green shores of the lake. The wise will stay here and hope to rebuild our town and enjoy again in time its peace and riches.
And riches.
It's such a wonderful speech, because he just gets that idea, doesn't he? You could either go back to that nasty, cold, desolate territory and be ruled by a king, or stay here and enjoy the profits that we're going to bring, and all the cake you can eat, and lots of cocaine. It'll be great.
Mm-hmm. It'll be great. Parties all the time. And it's interesting that the recategorization of Bard as king as mere fighting men.
Mere fighting men.
When that is one thing a category of Bard has not actually been, right? He's He's just a guy who then says, who's looking out for the people. And we're told immediately, what does Bard do? Looking at what Bard actually does, is he goes and immediately he rolls up his sleeves, getting his hands dirty, organizing the people, setting things right. He's not a fighting man. He's a person who's there for the people.
In fact,
whereas the master, it's the master, which is, again, it's just your choice of the word master, because you pointed that out, is the Greek word for that is despotes, despot. Despot is master. Master is despot. So just because somebody's elected and is a businessman does not mean that he's not a despot. In fact, perhaps more prone to being a despot than somebody who's chosen because of his merits.
Yes, but what is it that Hamilton says at one point in the Federalist Papers? He says, the true face of a despot more frequently hides behind the mask of a specious concern for the good of the people. I love that. We think, this guy, he's concerned with the good of the people. Look how he's building up the city. He wants us to enjoy peace and riches. Wait a minute. That guy's a despot. Okay. And I wonder if there wasn't, this is maybe projecting too much, I wonder in the future, was there then a pro-Dale faction and a pro-Esgaroth faction, you know, the Dalians versus the Esgarothians? I wonder if that...
Right, Guelph Ghibelline kind of
thing. Yeah, Guelph Ghibelline. Yes.
I think there could, a person could tell a story, like a fan fiction thing, that could be very interesting that way.
Yeah.
But I wonder if even, and I would grant that probably would happen. I mean, living in an Italian hill town, knowing very, this that very thing was part of our history here. I get froze for a second.
Yeah, look, battery on my
back. All right, back out of the time warp. You may have the factionalism, but you could have a king of Dale, and it may be precisely having a kingdom of Dale up in the north end of the lake that sets up the conditions where you can have a free mercantile town of Escarol on the lake at the south end. Not because they're under the king, like under a despot, but because it's the kingdom of Dale that makes that space where there can be that freedom for a middle class people, without the king, of course, relying just on themselves would cease to be.
Yeah, almost like he's still there to fight the dragon if the dragon crops up again, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly, he's there to protect them as a neighbor.
This is interesting. The dragon does crop up again, not to give away anything. The dragon does crop up again in the form of Thorin Oakenshield. Right?
Yes. Right.
Even though he doesn't look like a dragon, it says very explicitly he's infected with the dragon horde, you know, the desire.
Right.
If he was not checked by a miraculous event, namely the Battle of Five Armies, Thorin would have become a real despot, a real terror for the people. And he would have to be counteracted with a man of great courage and spine like Bard, not like the master of the
not like the master.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that we have, what is it now? We're on chapter 14, four more chapters of the book. Is again testimony to this idea that when the dragon is killed, that's not the end. There's still this period.
It's not the end.
All these details afterwards, but it's also testimony, I think, to Tolkien's sense of providence and providential existence. Mm-hmm. The fact that how am I trying to frame this? When we think of providence, we frequently think that this is God making everything perfect, and then the story ends, I got that Chris Kraft. I got that house on the lake. I'm now where I'm at. Thank you, Lord. And that's
it. All worked out.
Not that way, And providence is something which sometimes causes these cataclysms to occur, or allows these cataclysms to occur for a very specific reason. Get through what they need to get through. So here we have providence being. This is the power that guides the arrow of thought straight into the heart of the dragon. All a one in a million chance shot, right? And that kills the dragon and stops him from destroying Lake Town. It's very providential. Bard was in the right place at the right time with the right tools and the right personality. And so he's guided, his arrow is guided even by providence. But providence doesn't stop with everything being hunky-dory afterwards. This isn't the prayer of Jabez chapter, you know, where prophet and good looks accompany love of the Lord. But it is a chapter where I think by the end of it, you get this real sense that now you've got somebody who's going to be leading the men towards real life, no longer just this idea of prosperity.
That's exactly right. Towards real life, yeah. And not mere prosperity.
Yeah. That's
a good spot to...
Good spot to end it. Yeah. I think that the last thing to point out here is, as you mentioned earlier, the elves coming in, that area is cursed, but the elves come in and the men now are making an alliance with the elves. Tolkien frequently focuses on human beings in his stories. Elves are important, dwarves are, but what is it that men do? What is it that humans do? And here the men are being led towards real life, real prosperity at the end of this chapter. Which, as you were pointing out, that's a good place to end it, I think. A really good place to end it. Anything else that you wanted to bring up, or should we just say, hey, that's it. We're good.
I think we'll leave it at that.
Right. Good. Well, thank you. This has been another good thing. Thank you, Will.
Splendid.
So we'll end here, and hopefully we'll go back into our air-conditioned places and be able to survive, hopefully. All right, my friend. Farewell. Wherever you fare, to your Aries receive you at your journey's end.
And may the wind under your wings bear you where the sun sails and the moon walks.
God bless.
That concludes another episode of Avalon Mentors Podcast. Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed the show, would you kindly thumb the like button and also give the show a positive review on whatever platform you're listening on. Until next time, cast off the works of darkness and put upon you the armor of light. So long.